Hello, and welcome to the Mail Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Retall.
In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 comics sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. The numbers we'll be talking about in this episode are for the top 300 comics sold through Diamond to retailers for January 2012. Now, as you recall, Bob, last year when we talked about the January numbers for 2011, they were not so great. We had the top seller, of course, was the Death of Johnny Storm issue of Fantastic Four. But other than that, things were looking bleak. Then we got to February, and things were looking really bleak because there was no top seller or whatever. We're in a very different position this year. I think we're actually starting out with some very strong sales in a couple of places. And, you know, it's, I think, going to be a very pivotal year for comics. I think already we started with a very historic month where DC has actually taken the top 10 slots. They have never done that during the Final Order era when Diamond started reporting what was actually sold to retailers versus what they had just initially ordered. And actually, DC had been shut out of that list, I think, twice, at least once, during the... twice before, during that time. By Marvel.
Usually,
one time.
Marvel sneaks at least one book or two books onto that. I mean, the last, you know, few months, right?
Yeah, well, and this time around, you know, between... that 10th slot and 11th slot, I mean, there was a 1,600, 1,700 unit gap. So, I mean, they frankly should have been able to get something into the top 10.
And it's interesting that their top-selling book, right, is, you know, just over 63,000 units.
Yeah. It's under 64,000, and that brings up the 64,000 unit question of what's Marvel not doing right these days? They used to have a couple of franchises. I mean, a couple of years back, this is what the picture kind of looked like, but it was flipped between Marvel and DC. So I think this should be as much a cautionary tale for DC as it should be a wake-up call for Marvel right now, where, sure, whoever's top dog now, a couple of years from now, again, the pendulum could swing, it could go the other way. But it used to be the X-Men franchise was always top in the list, the Avengers franchise was top in the list, with healthy numbers. You know, right now we've got Justice League, Batman, Action, Green Lantern, those things up at the top of the list. We've got kind of that usual dead zone in that 80,000-ish area, which I always find entertaining, because it's like, there seems to be a segment of the audience that you can get up to about, you know, the 70, almost 80,000 mark, but then you're not that likely to land a title between the 80 and 90,000 range for some reason. Sometimes titles get in there, of course, but almost more often we'll have what we have here, where we've got, what is it, Green Lantern number 5 having done 97,891 units in rank 5, and then the next item, Batman the Dark Knight number 5, did 76,834 units. And it's like, there's a 20,000 unit gap right there. What is up with that? Is there 20,000 people that if you get one, you get them all? I mean, it's just, it's crazy. Again, doesn't always happen, but it happens enough that there's some aspect that we just don't have good visibility into that might explain that. You know, and it's interesting, because even with DC taking the top 10... the unit sales between Marvel and DC for the top 300 are not that far apart. DC came out on top with 42.63% of the total units sold for the top 300. They have had that top slot since the New 52 began, so 5 months in a row now. That's very impressive. That's more than they had had it ever prior to the New 52 during the Final Order era. They'd had it four times, I think, during that point. Out of like 100 months. But Marvel, while its percentage point's a little behind with 39.17%, so that's about a 3.5 unit gap almost. The total units for DC were in the 2.4 plus million. Marvel was at the 2.2 plus million, and the pluses were about equal. So really only about a 200,000 unit gap between the two. Which, you know, these days, one or two top sellers is enough to swing that.
Right.
You know, if the top book had not been from DC but had been from Marvel, these guys would have been neck and neck.
Yeah, certainly.
But I don't think the DC sales have necessarily come at the expense of the Marvel sales, but the Marvel stuff is it's sliding. You know, again, under 64,000 for their top book. What are they not doing right? And if this X-Men versus Avengers stuff, or Avengers versus X-Men, you know, whichever order it is, if that doesn't really pan out for them, are we likely to see a reboot of some sort, or a major, you know, shift in focus, or some major drastic change at Marvel, like we saw with the New 52? You know, at this point, while I still have some reservations on aspects of the New 52, and I'll be honest, as a reader, I haven't really reconnected with these new versions of characters as much as I would like. From a strictly looking at the numbers standpoint, though, it would be very difficult to consider the New 52 any kind of failure in any way, shape, or form. They've gotten people talking about the books. The books are selling. Sure, there's some drop-off. Yes, they've got six that they're retiring and replacing, or canceling and replacing, whatever terminology you want to use. But they've pretty much done what they've set out to do. They've re-baselined their books. They're selling well. There are a couple that look to be on the upswing, but really I think that's as much a matter of the returnability having ended on a few books, and therefore these things not being reported at reduced levels. But, you know, it would be hard, I think, for anyone to really mount a credible argument that the New 52 was a colossal failure.
True.
Certainly there are risks, again, with the detachment of characters and continuity, but, you know, it seems to have panned out pretty well for them so far.
Oh, certainly. It has. And, you know, it's... I'm just waiting for the other shoe to drop. You know, is Marvel going to jump on the bandwagon? But I would assume that they would do it in a way that doesn't overtly look like they're directly copying what DC did. You know, it's like maybe re-spinning, relaunching a lot of books, but not like a complete line-wide reboot.
It would be embarrassing for them to do that, given how they kind of mocked DC for doing it.
Right.
But I think part of what made the New 52 work was the fact it was line-wide. It was a very clear drawing a line in the sand, and then from there forward, stuff changed. I mean, I've had suggested that in years past around the time of, I forget if it was Infinite Crisis or whatever, but, you know, build up to something, have 1 week where that event happens, and then from there, it's all new. You know, and I think Marvel could do that. I think there's an argument that maybe they should do that. But, you know, as we're seeing with some of the lower-end DC titles, within short order, things are getting back down to those lower sales figures. So it's not a cure-all by any stretch of the imagination, but it certainly can refocus attention on the books. And, you know, I think Marvel needs to do something to get people back excited about their stuff.
Well, looking at diversity for a moment, you know, it's I am amazed at, I won't say, I probably doesn't go all the way to the level of amazed, given that I've been looking at this for so long, but there is so much replication in the top 50 and the top 100. You know, you start looking and it's like, Marvel, in particular, it's like, well, okay, they've got two issues of X-Men Legacy. They've got multiple issues of Wolverine. They've got multiple issues of Fear Itself, Fearless. They've got, you know, and it's just like they're double shipping. And, you know, DC's no better. I mean, just look at the top 10. I mean, it's Batman and some characters who are in the Justice League. I mean, it's the same stuff that is making the top 10. And it's not that, you know, it used to be, I would think, oh, well, people want something different. But the sales figures seem to indicate that people don't want something different. They want what they like, and they want more of the same.
Yeah, I think part of that is, I mean, familiarity. It's like, I know what Batman is, I know who the Justice League is, whether these are the exact same versions I'm used to or not, whatever. Versus, it could be a brilliant concept people would love, but how do you make them aware of that book and convince them to try it out? You know, you look at some of the lower-selling stuff out of the New 52 and related books, and a lot of that is, again, like you were saying, kind of the newer properties and whatnot. The Ray, which I think is a really fun book, very well done, it's down at rank 131 with 13,589 units, which goes towards the do people want something new or not. Flip side, right beneath that on DC at rank 132 is Static Shock. Fifth issue sold 13,552 units. Maybe not the longest track record or whatever, but Static Shock's been around a decade or two. And therefore, you could argue, you know, it's not just that being old is good, it's being old, recognized, and popular. That combination is kind of a hard trifecta. You know, obviously the Justice League characters have the leg up because not only are they Superman, Batman, you know, Flash, Green Lantern, Wonder Woman, the mainstream kind of characters, but by nature of that, a lot of them have been in the cartoons, in the movies, on TV, and have a wider awareness level, even if people haven't read the comics. Of course, you could argue Static Shock would fall into a little bit of that category with the cartoon.
But then, you know, given that after someone tried out the first issue, you know, given that the guys who are writing it, you know, because John Rossum is kind of denied all responsibility for it, are almost proud of the fact that they've never read a Static Shock comic book or watched an episode of the cartoon series in their life. You know, so how much is it leveraging that when there's no kind of touch point or familiarity to fans of those things?
Yeah, I've never understood why you would put somebody in charge of a property that's so proud of knowing nothing about that property whatsoever. I've seen this not only in comics, but on TV and a few other things. And, you know, Bruce Kalish, who was executive producer of Power Rangers for a season or two, basically phrased it as, you know, you're hired to paint a house, you're painting it red, all the neighbors hate it because it's this ugly red house, but that's what you were hired to do, you know, so you're going to paint the house red, you know. And he was one that had never watched Power Rangers, wasn't familiar with it, it's just, this is what I was tasked to do, and he did it. Did what he was tasked to do well, but that's not what the audience was wanting. And again, why put somebody on something like Static Shock that has no inclination or interest in what has gone before in the characters? For a serial narrative with this kind of audience that's so, to varying degrees, hung up on continuity and stuff, in some ways good, in some ways bad, but that's just a fact of the industry. Thumbing your nose at that is just foolish. You know, flip side, sometimes you can take a character, reinvent it, and do brilliant things. Look at not so much this Animal Man series, but the one before it that took a nothing character, reinvigorated it with some cool ideas or whatever, stayed true to the character, but, you know, went further with the premise, and you wound up with something that lasted, 130 issues, maybe a staggering run.
Yeah.
And has launched, you know, now another one that's doing pretty damn well. I mean, it's doing, 36,521 units, but it's just shy of being in the top 50. I think it's at rank, 53 there? So, you know, it's interesting how you get further on the list, particularly on the DC side. You see where they're starting to do more of the diversity, more reaching out into other areas, other genres, whatever, and it's just not working as well sales-wise. So, you know, I like that they're experimenting with that. I like how some of the new titles are, you know, The Ravagers, Dial H, and things like that are more on the, you know, that's probably not going to do gangbusters in terms of sales, But titles at this end of the spectrum, be it from Marvel, DC, or other publishers, they've got more room for upward growth. Because the odds of, you know, almost any of these books in the top 10 there, particularly that Justice League at the top slot, of it really skyrocketing in sales, that's just not going to happen. You know, the 138,594 estimated units, I really don't think that is sustainable over the long haul. Now, they could probably sustain it a year or two. Certainly when this title switches creative teams, that's going to be very interesting to see what happens with this title. And we're getting to the point with the New 52 where a couple of titles are flipping out creative teams with issue 8 or 9 or even 6 or 7 sometimes. 7, I think, sometimes. And it's that's really where the proof's going to be in the pudding, because are people going to use those as jumping off points? Are people going to say, well, you know, I didn't like the first one, I'm going to try out the second team? Don't know. It's a very odd time to be looking at the numbers, because we have so many different factors in play here, and so many of them are potentially major factors, from the reboot to, you know, what seems to be a growing disinterest and dissatisfaction with Marvel, to what's going on with digital, and with some stuff being underreported because of returnability. It's just, you know, it's a fascinating time. I really think we could see some interesting shifts happen over the course of the year. And, you know, it's nice that we've got a lot of titles starting off fairly strong, but that's almost exclusively for DC. How Marvel's looking here at the beginning of the year is really not all that different than last year.
Right.
But again, like you said, you look at the top stuff, it's a lot of X-Men-related stuff. Then you get some Spider-Man, a few Avengers thing, and it's a ways down before I think you get anything that's kind of out of their main X-Men, Avengers, or Spider-Man franchises. I would say Deadpool would be the top thing, not really out of those, although you could argue X-Men. And there was like a 40% drop almost on that Avengers X sanction with the second issue. Versus the alarming 54.71% drop on Defenders number 2. That went from 85,973 units down there at rank 43 down to 38,940 units. That's harsh. Now, that may also be a little misleading, because I think some of the Marvel books over the last at least 6 months, year, I'm not sure how far back or how widespread it is, I think some of them have been, let me see how to phrase this. I don't want to say over-reported, but potentially over-discounted and over-shipped, and this is where it comes down to really understanding what these numbers are and are not. These are what is invoiced to retailers. And if I sell you, Bob, a copy of a book, and then for every one you get, I ship you a second, so it's like half off it. Depending how that's phrased, one could argue you bought both of them at half price, or you only bought the one and I gave you the other. At which point, how many of those should count as sales or not? And I suspect, and I'm not at the point where I can completely explain this mathematically and stuff on the reporting side of it, but I think there have been some shenanigans of that sort going on over at Marvel.
Well, there's a difference between someone ordering 50 copies at 50% off, mm-hmm. right? They make a conscious decision to bring 50 copies into their shop versus ordering 25 copies and then after the fact being given an extra 25 free.
Yes.
Right? I mean, it's in one case they consciously made the decision to bring 50 copies into their shop. In the other case, they made a decision to bring 25 copies into their shop, and they were given another 25 to do with as they will. It was not a conscious decision on the part of the comic shop to bring 50 copies in the second instance there.
Well, in the way those that second case would get reported by Diamond is all 50 of those were, in some sense, invoiced to the retailer. So they would count on the unit side. So they'd be factored into the Diamond order index. They'd be part of the quantity ranking. But the retail ranking is based on the invoiced dollar amount. So only 25 of those would probably count there. So it would seem like it would have a much lower retail ranking, and we've seen this a couple of times in the past with the .1, I'm pretty sure with Defenders number 1. And I've been working on some things to quantify kind of how much would have sold at the full dollar amount based on where things did on the retail ranking. But because we've got so many things underreported and in some cases now overreported, if it was just stuff that was always skewed in one direction, it'd be pretty easy to identify. You just sort the list and go accordingly. But we've got enough shenanigans going on. Shenanigans in the overshipping way. Frankly, I think really smart business practices with the way DC's doing the returnability for the underreporting and stuff. And in some cases, massively discounting books like Swamp Thing, Wonder Woman, and a few others that they're trying to actively support and make easier for the retailers to buy and sell, that it makes clearly identifying some of the shenanigans in the other direction where I think Marvel is just kind of flooding the market. So this 54%+ drop, you know, in that light is not as alarming if a lot of the initial numbers were inflated because people were given, you know, for every so many copies, they got another one free or whatever it was. But this kind of overshipping is a... it can be a wise move, it can be a bad move. DC did some experiments at one point where they overshipped and tried to get to that saturation point to where retailers had as many copies as they could sell. Because it's more damaging, I think, for a retailer to have too few copies. Because if I don't get that first issue of Defenders, I'm not going to bother with the second. I haven't read the first. You know, so oversaturating on that first issue makes a certain degree of sense, but if a store ordered 25 and it looks like the numbers we're seeing it through Diamond are showing 50, that's misleading if those were just free, essentially promotional copies.
Right.
So I'm trying to work through the math and get that kind of cleaned up, defensible, and clearly explainable. The part that also makes it hard is that invoiced amount, I think, is going from what the retailers are paying, which is not the full dollar amount. It factors in the discount code. And the discount code for a lot of these equates to the quote-unquote standard discount. So suppose I had a store out here in Austin, Texas. You know, suppose it was, you know, I mean, again, we got a couple out here. These stores are doing okay, but they're selling X number of copies. I'm willing to bet one of the main stores out by you in the heart of the L.A. Metroplex or out in the New York area for people over there, average store there is probably selling that X times 4 or 5 or whatever just because they have a bigger customer base to deal with. Not that they're any better or worse store or whatever. It's just a matter of that. So the standard discount is based on the volume for the retailers. People at the smaller cities and stores are going to have a little less of a discount. Those at the upper end of the spectrum are going to have a bigger one, and I think that factors into that invoiced amount that determines the retail ranking. So the math on it gets a little nebulous and a little ugly on that side. But that's also why I think we've been seeing, particularly from Marvel, what looks to be some really harsh second issue drops.
Yeah.
Which kind of indicates that the overshipping probably not working out all that well for them. Now, DC, as we said, has decided to end 6 of the new 52 titles and replace them with a Wave 2. What's interesting, and we talked about this a little, I think, last month, is it's 6 of the 7 lowest selling. Captain Atom somehow having dodged the bullet there. And I'm still not quite sure how it managed to do that at this point.
I'm guessing, just a guess, that maybe they've got some plan to do some crossover with the character into Justice League or something, and they don't want to pull the plug on it for that reason. I mean, there's got to be some kind of reason.
Yeah, either that or, you know, Freddie Williams is enough ahead it didn't make sense, or I don't know. It'll be interesting to see if that becomes a little more clear as we get some of the future solicitations and see those issues or what have you. If I were at DC, what my inclination would be to do at this point is wait until, say, the issue 12s to end any more titles. In other words, space out the waves of new titles. But if they're smart, they've got another half dozen or so ready, and it's just whatever's down near the bottom at that point, retire those titles, replace them with new ones. And do that, again, Chris and I talked about this a little, do that, you know, on a four-month basis, to where it's not like you're always, it's like, oh, damn, here's another wave of new titles every quarter or every month or whatever. It gives each wave a little bit of a clear field before the next wave kind of steals the spotlight.
Yeah, maybe little smaller batches, you know. It's like, you know, dropping six and throwing on six new ones is kind of a lot. You know, maybe if they do three or four.
I think if you only do three or four, it's not big enough to do any kind of it's a big deal-ish thing. And I think if you do more than about six, it's too much.
Do they really want to make a big deal out of the fact that they're canceling six titles every 4 months? I mean,
I'm not saying they necessarily have to do it every 4 months. But if you get to where you have enough things under that 20,000 mark, you know, it kind of makes sense to say, okay, let's close those off or whatever. Would I like to see all 52 just keep going on going? Certainly, but I don't think that's realistic. And over the course of the year, I guess that would give you two dozen new titles. But if you look at how it had been going kind of prior to the new 52 and how it seems to be at Marvel, I mean, new number ones, if you just trickle them out every, you know, two or three a month or whatever, they just get lost in the noise. It's what's new this month. And if you can focus them, and maybe, you know, four would be enough. I don't know. It's, I would like to see it to where it's not cancellations every month, new titles every month, and just constant churn, and get more towards a, I don't want to say a season mentality, but that there are times where that they would, you know, you've got a, I don't say a guarantee of another four issues or whatever, but space out the chopping block interval, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see how they decide to go moving forward. I like how some of these replacement titles are kind of the expected, like Batman Incorporated and stuff. Others are like the Earth 2 titles, kind of, we'd been hearing rumors of that, so it's not too surprising. But then a few of these others are, I think, riskier moves. The Dial H, the Ravagers again. And I would encourage them to keep doing titles at that lower expected sales range or whatever. Because if they can do those and they're viable and they catch on, again, there's the growth opportunity. But I think that the rules of viable comic book publishing or whatever are starting to change, both with the digital and other influences and stuff. You know, I look at My Greatest Adventure. It's at rank, I think, what is that? 193 with issue 4. It's at 7,592 units. That's got stuff by Aaron Lopresti, Kevin Maguire. I forget who's doing the Robot Man story, but it's good stuff. But at the $3.99 price tag for three 10-page stories, I think a lot of people just aren't into that. Now, maybe with digital, they can make those 10-page stories viable in that format at a 99-cent price or, you know, whatever would work, and then later compile them into comics or trades or whatever. But DC's kind of on the fence here of saying, well, the digital stuff's all an additive market. Okay, based on the numbers, I'm willing to believe that. I don't see that these numbers are really any lower than I think they would have been if digital was not there. But then they're also starting to do things like Smallville Season 11, and they're doing the Batman Beyond stuff digital first, and then a month or so later getting into print. Well, if it's an additive market, why go that way? And I'm not saying it's a bad move. I'm just curious what their motivation is. And if you think about it, both those properties have strong, in the Batman Beyond area, cartoon basis, and obviously Smallville, the TV show. So it makes sense that you can get a mass audience kind of a thing into those properties if they push them right, which might then migrate them into other comics and possibly even to comic book stores. But with digital having apparently tripled in size or whatever over the last year, according to some of what's come out of the Comics Pro conference or whatever that was up in Dallas recently, and starting to hit high single-digit percentage of revenue or whatever, it's becoming a bigger deal, but still under, I think, 10% of what these companies are making. So not big enough they can shift over to it as a primary revenue stream. But if it's tripling and continues to continue to grow over the next few years, it could become a dominant stream. You know, take over the role that I thought at one point trades might do of becoming the cash cow, and the comics are not the primary revenue stream. I mean, at which point the model shifts and what they're writing for changes.
Right.
You know, I think people are writing for the trades because you hit the things like Walking Dead and a few others, Fables, that, you know, the individual comic sales issues are a flash in the pan. You get it the first week, month, whatever. But then you've got this long lifetime shelf life of the trade. For the average superhero book, I really don't think that is true. I don't know how well the average New Mutants trade paperback sells, or what the expectations would be for the new Suicide Squad, when it hits trade, stuff like that. And there's nothing wrong with those titles. It's just not something that I think there's the long-term interest on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense. Now, I was looking at, I hadn't done this in a while or ever. I was looking at the list here kind of in relation to what I'm getting, because I've been doing all those cuts, and it's actually kind of interesting to me. It doesn't seem unusual. It's like as I've been pulling more and more away from the mainstream type of stuff, but when I look at the top 50 comics here, I physically purchased 27 of the top 50. But if I filter out ones that I've got out of the top 50 but I've decided to cancel, as I'm not getting them anymore,
right,
I'm only getting 22 of the top 50 on an ongoing basis. Like, as a for instance, I'm not getting Batman the Dark Knight anymore. Scarlet Spider, while I got the first issue that's here at slot 21, I'm not buying Scarlet Spider on an ongoing basis. So, technically, of the top 50 that are on this chart, I physically purchased 27 of them. But as far as kind of an ongoing basis of those series, I'm only getting 22 of them, which is less than half of the top 50.
That's where our buying habits really differ.
Right.
Because I'm just going through real quick and through the top 100 or so.
Yeah, there's probably not a single thing you don't get.
Actually, there's a few. The first item on the list that, and I did this fast, so I may have goofed once or twice, but the first one I noticed that I wasn't getting was at rank 61 with that Carnage USA. There may be one or two that I got the first issue of but may not be planning to move forward with, but I was just going for the specific issues. Followed by at rank 63, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Season 9. Then down to rank 80 with Punisher, then down to...
Oh, you're not getting that anymore? Because you used to get the Buffy stuff religiously.
I did, but I backed out when they started the ninth season. I decided I just didn't need to keep going with that. And it's not that it's bad, it just is... Like, you've been making massive cuts because of how big your reading list is. I mean, I'm getting, on average, about 40 a week. So when there are some new titles that it's like, I like but don't love, and it's an offshoot kind of off on its side that if I don't get, I won't miss, it's easy to make some choices there. But, other than that, out of the top 100, Fatale, Danger Girl Revolver, and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles are the only other ones I'm not getting.
Out of the top 100, I physically got 44 of them, but only 34 are sticking with me on an ongoing basis. So my latest round of cuts has excised about 10 of the books I was getting in the top 100.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the middle 100, I physically got 29 of them, 25 I'll be continuing with, so it didn't have as much of a hit. And then in the bottom 100, I physically got 33, 28 of which are things that I plan to get on an ongoing basis. So, I mean, I'm relatively evenly spread out between the top, middle, and bottom third of the list. You know, so if I look at stuff I'm getting on an ongoing basis, I'm 34, 25, 28. You know, so I'm getting more of the top 100 than the bottom 100, but I'm getting a lot of books in the bottom 100 just because a lot of the quirky, off the beaten path things that I tend to really like are down there. And then, you know, if I add all those up, it tells me that I'm getting about, you know, 20 books that don't even make it on the list.
Yeah. Well, and our reading habits have diverged. I tend to be obviously very heavy on the top half. I'm getting a decent number of the stuff at the bottom. I haven't gone through and calculated how many of them, but I tend to be more in the mainstream type stuff. A lot less on the back half of previews, the you know, the non-Marvel DC stuff. And that's just, you know, where my interests are. There's nothing right or wrong about that, but it is interesting to see kind of where people's titles tend to land. And I think there's a lot of people who are in kind of the boat you're in, that obviously a finite number, that are getting and are very loyal and fans and followers of titles near the lower part of the list. But that doesn't seem to be enough to kind of, I don't say keep things going there, but you know what I mean? It's a remarkably finite list because really, you know, when you get at rank 200, sales are 72,000, under 7,200 units. So, you know, there's only a few thousand people that are getting, you know, these titles and stuff. And even if they're getting a couple of them and getting them religiously, that's a very different kind of an audience than the 70,000 or whatever that we see up near the top of the list.
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, going down to the bottom again, like we always do. I mean, it's just Elephant Men, which is one of my top 20 books. You know, when mm-hmm. I had to pick, you know, if I was only going to get 20 comics, what comics would they be? You know, Elephant Men was on that list for me. And it's only, yeah, it's less than 3,000 people getting that. Yeah, you know, it's 2938 estimated units. I mean, that's very low, and that's a very good book. I like it. It's taking qualitative off. It's subjective, but it's one of my favorite books, and it's not that many people are getting it. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of books down here near the bottom that I enjoy quite a lot, and you know, like Usagi Yojimbo. Wow, that is a phenomenal book. That's in my top 20. 4789.
Mm-hmm.
You know, great, great book.
Well, and that's one that is of such consistent quality. It's not like you're going to like it and then suddenly get turned off by it. You may get tired of it, but it's more or less been the same quality throughout. Good, done in one or a few multi-part stories. Each issue is satisfying, read, whatever. You know, I'd been hearing good things about that book for probably its entire run, actually, now that I think about it. I had a friend in high school who was big fan of it then, big fan of it now. Again, good, consistent quality, whatever. Yet, you know, it used to be selling around 8,000. It's getting down, you know, to where it's now, what did you say it was, the 4,000-ish area? Yeah, 4,000.
Just close to 5,000, yeah, but, you know.
4,789, yeah. And that's just minor attrition. I mean, this time it lost maybe a half dozen units, give or take, maybe not. But, you know, you lose a little bit, you know, over the span of 100-plus issues. That does add up.
Yeah, and I mean, they're not one to be rebooting the numbering and doing all these other kind of things to pump up the sales. And I don't know that, you know, for a book like that, it's not going to have the same effect if you do that. It's not like you're going to restart it at number one and suddenly 50,000 people are going to buy it, you know?
Yeah. The reality is, I think, for a lot of these books, there is a almost a glass ceiling of some sort for how much they're going to sell. And it's got nothing to do with quality, of course, or even timeliness or anything of the sort. It's part of that glass ceiling is set by how many stores are actually getting these books in, you know, and on the rack. You know, that's a definite gating factor. And as good as Usagi Yojimbo is, part of what helps it over some of the others is the fact it's by Dark Horse, not like self-published or something. If it were a self-published book, it would probably be selling less than this. Just because a lot of stores, you know, they order from the premier publishers, and it's really not worth their time sometimes to go for that back half.
Well, that's kind of the unlevel playing field between Marvel and DC. More so Marvel, I think. Although, maybe DC. You know, it's like, you could restart Usagi Yojimbo that's selling a little less than 5,000. And maybe it would jump up to 7,500 or something. I don't know. I mean, I don't think you'd gain 20,000 units on it. But, no. You know, quite frequently you'll have a Marvel book or a DC book that is down under 20,000. They restart it and, you know, the sales, at least for the first issue, will jump up around 50,000. And then they'll start dropping, you know, maybe the second issue they'll be around 30. But, I mean, they've essentially doubled the sales on the book, you know, which it'll attrition from there. But just by doing some renumbering scheme, they've, you know, just doubled the sales on the book.
Well, yeah, and because they've
I don't think that happens with
indie they've got books. Not so much a reset button, but a turbo boost button, I guess would be the way to put it, where they push that, and they've done it frequently on some of the X-Men and Avenger books. And it just spikes the sales for a month or two as it gets back down to a level, you know, about where it was at. Sometimes it'll get higher, rebaseline it or whatever. But there's only so many times you can be pushing that button. And you're right, it works fundamentally differently on a creator-owned book on the back half. Just because the people that are going to be reading against something like Usagi, apparently for the most part already are, which boggles my mind because I think there are a lot more people that would like it than are reading it. And it's not just unique to that title. I mean, there have been a lot of books that I'm a hardcore reader of comics. I don't think anyone could make a case that I'm not, at least not one that I would believe. I mean, out of the top 300 here, I'm getting at least 176 of these, and that was just a quick pass through the list here. Yet I'm routinely finding, be it a Usagi Yojimbo, Elephant Men, Toopy Doops, some other stuff that just had a low enough profile that I was aware of, but not aware of enough to realize I should be getting that. I'm really going to love that. Again, I don't think I jumped on Loving Capes when it first came out. I think it took me until at least the first Free Comic Book Day edition or something like that. Matter of fact, I'm certain it took at least 4 or 5 issues for me to get into that. There is not just the unlevel playing field, but nobody has really cracked the code for how to get the right books in front of the right readers for that book. And with digital, one of the potential game changers, and I'm not familiar enough with the platforms to know if it's out there yet, and I don't think it is kind of the equivalent of like what an Amazon would have of, you know, people who bought this also get this. And I think, and I've suggested this to a number of people in the past, that one of the opportunities a group like Comics Pro has is to be pooling their resources and compiling a list of essentially sales tips. If you've got somebody who likes Fables because of Bill Willingham, suggest title A, B, and C. If they like it because of Mark Buckingham, the artist, suggest titles X, Y, and Z. If they like it because of the content and the genre, recommend this, that, and the other. And having those kind of, and it'll change over time, of course, but those kinds of pathings of start here and you'll get to there, really, I think, have the opportunity to take somebody who likes, you know, whatever, and direct them towards an Elephant Man, a Usagi Yojimbo, a what have you. The opportunities for the sales on this bottom half to just skyrocket if the right people get them in front of them in the right way is insane.
I mean, we've talked about that kind of intelligence engine before.
Yeah.
You know, maybe not on the show, but at least, you know, it's kind of
maybe once or twice on the show.
Talking around about it. I mean, just, I mean, that would be an interesting knowledge engine to build. I don't know how you would necessarily make any money out of it, you know.
Well, digitally, it's very clear how you would make money out of it. At the end of an issue, would you like to read more?
No, I'm just saying, yeah, sure. If I'm saying as an independent person, you know, could you make that kind of an intelligence engine and sell it to, you know, whomever, Comixology or whatever, or is Comixology maybe building something like that on their own?
If they're not, they should be.
Yeah.
Because with the digital comics, you've got the sales information. Reader X got this, and particularly since they have ratings. You know, if somebody loved Walking Dead and Morning Glories, and they picked up Thief of Thieves, depending how they rate the three, that tells you should you be recommending that or not.
Right. I mean, Amazon's got that, you know, built in. When you look at something or buy something, they say, oh, you might also like, you know, this.
It's something that in physical comic stores, the people there are limited to what they've seen their customers buy, and that's if they're paying attention. And that's, I don't mean that as a slam or anything. It's tough to do, because when I would go to the comic store, I'd put down a stack of 24 books. I would do that every week. Are they going to notice how my reading habits have shifted because of that? No, they're cycling through just how quickly can they ring it up. But when I've gone to brick-and-mortar stores and, gee, what would you recommend? Now, and a lot of times, particularly these days since I buy, you know, through DCBS, even when I do it over at Tribe Comics, and these guys know their stuff, they read the books, they've got well-formed and well-thought-out opinions. The disadvantage they have initially is they'll recommend four or five titles, which, of course, I'm usually already getting. But they've had a few others of, hey, you know, have you thought about this? What about that? And it's one of the few stores I've been in where they've got enough awareness of what's out there to be able to make some good recommendations and why they're making them, which I think is always an added benefit. Again, I go back to the example of Joe from Comics Gallery Mira Mesa, you know, a decade or more back, where he would routinely be able to pick out books in this lower selling section of, you know, you like what's going on this title, try this one out. And it's something that I just never would have stumbled across, even though it was in previews, it was sitting there on the rack, it was in plain sight. If somebody can crack that and make that work, that's going to be one of the things that helps boost sales just across the board. And I think digital is poised to do that just because they're in the right position. But for that matter, I think, you know, DC and Marvel and stuff could be doing a better job of pointing me to, hey, if you liked what was happening in this issue, check out these other things, either by this artist, by this writer, with these characters, in this genre, or what have you. You know, really, if their sales and marketing staffs have not, and I'm sure they have not, drawn out this kind of sales progression diagram or whatever, it would be smart for them to do that. You know, let's take the readers of Superboy and steer them towards Teen Titans. From there, we could steer them towards, you know, these other books or what have you.
And I think DC's actually trying to do that. It's just, how are they trying to do that? You know, it's different to me for someone to give me a recommendation when I'm buying the thing, and whether that's, you know, if I'm buying it digital, Comixology, the comic shop, DCBS say, oh, I see you're buying this, would you be interested in that? Versus the way the publisher takes it in hand, particularly DC, on cramming in crossovers between the different titles, you know, where it's kind of like making, you know, and I noticed that in their May solicits that have been out on the web, you know, that they've got this, and it's not as bad of a crossover with the Court of Owls thing, but that's an 11-part, you know, Court of Owls tie-in, and they're tying in all these different DC, all the different Batman family titles are all being tied in together, mm-hmm. right? But then they're doing some other explicit crossovers. They're doing this culling storyline that starts in Teen Titans Annual number 1, and explicitly it's a story that continues into Superboy number 9, Legion Lost number 9, and Teen Titans number 9, and then they spin that new Ravagers series out of it, saying, you know, this is the first issue spinning directly out of the culling. And then they're doing a crossover between Justice League International and Firestorm. They're doing a crossover between Blue Beetle and the New Guardian, Green Lantern New Guardians. They're doing a crossover, and these are explicit crossovers like part one, part two.
Yeah.
You know, like they did with Justice League Dark and iVampire. And then they're crossing over Suicide Squad and Resurrection Man. And, you know, that's their mechanism for trying to steer people from one place to another. And maybe that works with some people. I tend to resent it, you know.
Well, they're trying to literally pave roads between titles and reroute traffic. Whereas I think if you can get people who are liking Swamp Thing to realize Animal Man is a very similar title, you might like that. Give it a try. Now, granted, story-wise, they're clearly going to dovetail those books into some kind of quasi-crossover flip sides of the rot or what have you. But they've also introduced one or two things concept-wise, just in passing, of the Veil and something else. Two other things that are kind of, sort of, but not quite like the Red and the Green. You know, it's like, ooh, are other titles going to play into that? And is that something that if I like those kinds of concepts, I should be checking something else out? They should be enticing, not forcing, people between books. And, you know, it's a tough thing to do. And like when they had Green Lantern crossover into Voodoo, there was nothing about that that, at least for me, made me think, wow, I should go follow this character back into, you know, Green Lantern and the New Guardians, which has had no connection really to the Voodoo crossover appearance at all. So,
and that's different when, so
this it's a guest star, yeah.
It's a guest star appearance, right? And I'm fine because I'm not getting Voodoo, so I was completely unaware that that had even happened. But I mean, at least if you do something like that, like when they had Batman pop into iVampire.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was less enthused about that because it was polluting my horror comic with superheroes, right? But if that was, you know, some other kind of thing where if they like went and stuck Blue Beetle into a Green Lantern comic, right? At least they're both superhero comics. I don't feel like they're kind of cross-genreing me. And then I might say, oh, this Blue Beetle character, they made him seem really cool. Maybe I'll go check out Blue Beetle. But that's different than when they do a part one, part two story thing
mm-hmm.
between the two books, was what they're doing with issue 9 of those books. Now, I see that there's different ways for this to go. I mean, like, for instance, they're crossing over Blue Beetle 9 with the New Guardians number 9. Well, I get both of those books, so, you know, hey, no big deal. You know, it's like I'll get both those books. I will get both parts of the story. So that's the one case where you're getting both of them already. Now they're crossing over Justice League International with the Firestorm, right? Well, I don't get either of those books. So again, zero effect on me because I don't get either one. But then there's the case with the other crossover. It's Suicide Squad with Resurrection Man. Well, I do get Resurrection Man. I don't get Suicide Squad. So what does that do to me? Now I have a decision point, right? So now it's like, okay, do I just keep getting Resurrection Man and hope that I don't get an incomplete feeling story? Do I pick up Suicide Squad that month just so I get the whole story? Or do I, which is not the desired case for DC, do I say, oh man, I don't want to read an incomplete story, so I'm going to drop Resurrection Man?
Well, it's funny because I think you're on the opposite side than presumably the majority of people are going to be, because Resurrection Man number 5 sold 18,677 units, whereas Suicide Squad sold 29,457 units. So that's
So more people are getting Suicide Squad.
10,000 more.
Yeah.
So is that going to help Resurrection Man at all, or are they risking alienating a Resurrection Man fan who, for whatever reason, isn't getting Suicide Squad? Now, the Blue Beetle series, issue 5, did 17,140 units. Which Green Lantern title is that one crossing over into?
New Guardians.
New Guardians, which is selling 52,312 units. So, I mean, there's a pretty huge gap between those two. And how many of those New Guardian fans are going to check out Blue Beetle? And even if any significant number do, which is possible, is that going to have any lasting repercussions on the sales there?
It's funny because on the Suicide Squad Resurrection Man, right, the first part's in Suicide Squad. So that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
You start in the one that's selling more, mm-hmm. and then you continue the story into the one that's selling less. And it's like, oh, well, if I like the story, I'm going to go and keep my eye out for Resurrection Man, right?
Right.
On the Blue Beetle, Green Lantern, New Guardians, the story starts in Blue Beetle and continues the New Guardians. So I'm going to pick up my New Guardians issue, and it's like, oh, this is the second part of a story that happened first in Blue Beetle over there. And it's like, well, wait a minute, that came out last week or so. I don't know what weeks they ship on, you know. Theoretically, they're not shipping on the same week or something. So is the person even going to be able to find a copy of Blue Beetle number 9?
Right, right.
When there's that big of a gap between those two series.
Blue Beetle ships the week before New Guardians, which is part of why they're ordering it that way.
Right, which, again, you know, so someone's going to come into the shop, they're going to pick up New Guardians, and if they didn't pick up Blue Beetle because they're not aware of that, it's like, oh, well, let me get Blue Beetle number 9. And it's like, oh, well, sorry, we don't have any copies of that. Now you got someone who's just pissed off, right? You know, it's mm-hmm. like they want to buy that issue. Oh, well, you can go buy it digital, you know? It's like, well, okay.
It'll be interesting to see if on the cover it's clear of both Blue Beetle and New Guardians that that's going to happen.
And then on the Justice League one, I don't know what order those are in. I'm guessing whichever one ships first.
Which would be...
Justice League International.
Yeah. It's earlier in the month than the other one, than Firestorm.
Okay. Now, so again, that's got to sell way more copies than Firestorm.
What's interesting, and again, it's a little hard to read too much into this with the returnability and other aspects of the way things are being reported right now, but iVampire number 5, which had that Batman crossover, still dropped by almost 13% from the previous issue. So it's not like there was any influx of readers on that because Batman showed up. So where there are cases where they can do some interesting stories, like I think the Blue Beetle Green Lantern stuff falls into, that makes sense to do crossovers, where it's a forced thing of, you know, let's pollute your supernatural book with a superhero there. Clearly that didn't boost sales or even stem the drop-off. And, I mean, with iVampire selling under 17,000 units on that issue, the lowest-selling Batman title is Batman and Robin at over, well, 65,516. So, again, wide margin there. I don't think these ploys of the crossovers and stuff have the sales benefit these days to justify doing them on those grounds. But clearly some of these publishers and creators and editors feel otherwise.
Right.
I mean, it used to be that they would work great. But even the couple of times we've seen massive influxes on titles, at best, the next issue would be up slightly from the one before the crossover, and then the one after that, so two after the crossover, it would be back in line with how the title was selling. You know, if you took those two up issues out, it'd be, again... straight line curve kind of a deal on the trend. It's remarkable how often that happens, that you could almost say, okay, based on how everything fell in line, this is about where those other two issues or issue or one or two issues would have sold, and almost guesstimate how much the crossover benefited them. And sometimes it can be huge. I mean, we saw the powering promotion for Blackest Night and stuff. That boosted some titles, you know, four or five times their regular sales. and maybe the issue after that would be up 5 or 10% from the issue prior to the Power Ring issue. So, but then, boom, back down to where it was. You know, the fact that we're seeing some of these titles down at the, you know, under 13,000 level sales is explaining why, you know, titles like Blackhawk are going away. You know, the fact that they've let it get that low, and again, returnability, these are lower numbers, et cetera, et cetera. You know, they're at least trying to give these books a shot.
Right.
And I appreciate that. But I'm going to be curious again, by this time next year, what's the lineup of titles at DC look like? How many of these are still around? How many have been rotated out? Have they added more? Have they not?
I'm just curious how long it'll take for the new 52 to be, you know, 30 Batman titles, 10 Green Lantern titles.
Yeah.
You know, and then 5 Superman titles, you know, or something. It's just ridiculous on how the interest level seemed to skew towards some of the more popular franchises, which, you know, again, Batman's a very popular character. People like Batman. People like Wolverine, you know.
But would anyone have expected, prior to the New 52, Aquaman being a top 10 title?
That's the one that, again, that's the one that's the pleasant surprise for me, because that's the only DC superhero book that made it into my top 20.
Mm-hmm. And it's a great book, but you put a really good creative team on it, what do you expect? And a team that clicks with the property. If they can be, over time, finding, and Marvel needs to do this too, those right creators for the property that just really click and just go off, that takes some time, but it really comes down to, do you have a good talent scout in your editorial team who can do that kind of matchmaking and say, you know, let's put Hickman on Fantastic Four. Let's go put Bendis on the Avengers back when they made that decision. You know, things like that. If they can be getting to that point, keeping the books coming out on time, keeping those creators on those books, they could be just working their way through their lineup and starting to really strengthen each individual title. But that's something that takes a focused effort, and you're going to have some definite misses along the way.
Right.
But I've got to think that there is somebody that they could put on almost any of those lower selling titles that could have completely turned it around. Now, whether they could keep them on there or not is another matter. So it's very interesting time to be looking at these numbers. We're only a couple of months away from the trades coming out to see how those do. And it's I really think a potential maker, I don't say make or break year, but a pivotal year for Marvel. They need to shake things up. They need to do something. And I really gut feeling, I don't think the Avenger X-Men, you know, fight is going to do it. I think they're marketing the wrong thing to the audience.
The one thing that we didn't think of when you're looking at, you know, why is Captain Atom not getting canceled, right? Because mm-hmm. it's lower selling than Hawk and Dove.
Although only by less than 100 units, only about 80 units or so.
Well, I'm curious on digital, you know, because that's the big unknown, because we don't ever see and probably will not ever see objective sales figures of digital. You know, is for some reason Captain Atom just got some freakishly strong, compared to the other bottom-selling titles, you know, digital following or something.
Having similar-ish data to this on the digital side would be very insightful, potentially a lot more than what we get out of these numbers. Because since they have sales to readers, that in and of itself gets rid of the quote-unquote overshipping, and that just doesn't happen in digital. And just being able to see how these titles rank relative to each other on the digital side, I think, like you said, is Captain Atom for some reason, you know, a top 20 book in DC for digital or not, you know, would potentially give us some insight. The other thing I'd like to see out of that is, you know, do they see, how do those sales trend over time, and how does that get impacted by when they do the, okay, it's a dollar cheaper because it's been 4 weeks, or it's a 99-cent blockbuster weekend for this group of titles or whatever, how does that skew sales? There's a lot of very good data and data mining opportunities with the digital information that I think could then be fed back into how print sales work. Granted, I'm not saying it'd necessarily be a one-to-one thing, but we'd have better visibility into how successful those crossovers are or are not, and then what gets learned from there on how to change the storytelling or promotion of these stories on that avenue, I think would benefit how they sell in print. So I think there's a lot of opportunities to be had there. You know, we'll see if that information, you know, becomes available. And I don't expect necessarily unit sales or whatever, but I still think there's other information that they might be able to release that would be very insightful and beneficial for the industry.
Right.
So, anything else, or does that pretty much do it?
It does it for me.
Cool. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening. The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If they differ from your reality, please verify you're in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. If you're a resident of some other space-time continuum, please limit any actions you may take to that alternate reality. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes to 2 decimal places, and therefore there's a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. For months in which no issue of Batman or Detective shipped, Batman: The Battle for the Cowl was used instead. The title used as the key title is irrelevant. If you do not understand why or do not believe this, please consider taking a refresher course on basic algebra. Math is fun, but only if you understand it. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Sell-through information is not currently available, and we limit our reporting to the available information. If, however, you enjoy fiction, please listen to this preview spotlight for our recommendations of upcoming comic books. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications that at least one retailer may have excessive amounts of empty shelf space with dust that needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold to Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 300 comic books for the month in question. The list of the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to the retailers for the month in question. More than 300 graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, the list of the top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 100, 50, 25, or as few as 10 items on the list. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which, as far as we know, has not been invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic book, graphic novel, or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 300 graphic novels and collected edition lists are included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. For some strange reason, Diamond doesn't report on sales to competing distributors. No information about the sales or lack of sales of any item sold outside of Diamond's comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. We limit this report to the available data. If more data becomes available, we'd be happy to include it. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for. No amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer is here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is inapplicable in the alternate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Math, logic, and the English language itself seem to work very differently there. I have neither the time nor the interest in engaging in pointless debates in this hypothetical reality. There are no guarantees of accuracy, reliability, completeness, or timeliness of any of the information given in the course of this discussion. We are human, and sometimes we make mistakes. We appreciate your understanding in this area. Any statements that may contain projections or other predictions about future events should be viewed as opinions that are subject to change as new information becomes available. Actual events may unfold in unexpected ways. As Doc Brown once said, the future is what you make of it. If any statements are contradicted or contested, the participants of the discussion may disavow any knowledge of those statements.